This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today for our monthly Editor's Roundtable. We gather some news pros to talk about the stories that have been making headlines for the last month and might be making headlines for the months to come as well. Some of these are chestnuts because we talk about them virtually every time we assemble our roundtable. And a regular member is our Prairie Public News Director, Dave Thompson, who joins us from our microphone in Bismarck. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Doug.
And Jim Olson is with us by phone from Minot. He is KXMC-TV's news director. Hello, Jim.
Good morning to you, or afternoon, I guess it is now, isn't it?
It is already. And Joe Radsky is with me here in the Fargo studio. Joe is the news director for KVRR-TV in Fargo. Thanks for being with us, Joe.
Good day, everyone.
And let's start with the economy. The Dow is in a plummet. It's been down as much as 550 points or so today. It's down over 400 right now. And, of course, that's a reflection of the turmoil caused by a recent decision, I think. The market is reacting to the decision by China to impose tariffs against some U.S. goods, retaliation for the tariffs that were applied against them by the Trump administration. So let's go with oil first, Dave. Jim, you're out there in that particular part of the state. Oil prices are down a bit today, but they've still been drilling.
Absolutely. And Jim is closer to it than I am right now. But, yeah, we're seeing the activity, you know, has been picking up since the low point of oil prices. But now oil prices are above $50 a barrel, and people are drilling again, so it looks like some activity back in the oil patch.
Definitely. We're very close to record production in oil. We're at record production in natural gas right now in the state. So the industry has certainly been kind of climbing back slowly and surely. But, it's interesting. I was looking at some of the taxable sales and receipts from the mm-hmm. State Tax Commission. And it's kind of, it's indicative of where we stand, because even though there was a 3% increase in taxable sales and purchases last year over 2016, that still left us well below the heady years of about 2014, which was the high point. And it's kind of interesting to me that back in 2014, for the year, the number one county for taxable sales in the state was Williams County, which is Williston, mm-hmm. about 50% higher than Cass County. And yet last year in 2017, you can more than reverse that. Cass County is about double what Williams County was in 2017, and the overall number is about a third of what it was for Williams County. So even though there is a rebound in production, there is certainly not a rebound in the huge economic activity out in the western part of the state.
And Jim and Dave as well, I just was reading recently about the interest in really increasing significantly the state's capacity to handle natural gas, maybe even doubling it in the near future. And that suggests a lot more oil is going to be pumped.
Yes and no, because if you look at Bakken wells, the oil will actually decline, but the natural gas stays pretty high. So there's a lot of gas being produced by the existing wells, and we're flaring a lot. And they're trying to cut the amount of flaring down. I think the next goal is to be less than 12% flaring. Jim, is that correct?
Right. 11%. I think it's 89%, something
right.
like that. Yeah. So, they're pushing that up all the time. And that's just a natural byproduct, I guess, of mm-hmm. that, as well as the fact that natural gas is a byproduct of the drilling. But, right, and that really fluctuates also the interest in it with the price. You know, a year and a half ago, the price was pretty high for natural gas, I believe. It's somewhat lower now. But nevertheless, they have the incentive to collect the gas. And so, as I said, we're at a record production rate for natural gas. And I think you're right that that'll just keep going up.
And I did read that as these wells are pumped lower and lower, the gas that is produced increases, and some parts of the Bakken produce more gas than others. But still, they were talking about doubling the capacity. And I remember not so long ago, the state's oil and gas interests were talking about perhaps doubling the current output. It's over 1 million barrels a day still, isn't it? And that would be near 2 million barrels a day still. That would be near Texas.
That's correct. And if you know, Governor Burgum does have that as a stated goal that he'd like to see 2 million barrels taken out of the Bakken every day. That we'll see what if that happens.
Well, that would make life in the oil patch different again, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's for sure. But again, this pullback that we had in the industry because of the lower prices has really helped those oil companies kind of refocus and learn how to produce at a lower cost, which means, you know, less of a boom, so to speak, as far as work, you know, and jobs and that sort of thing, but still a good production. So, you know, kind of two sides of the coin there. They'll increase production, but they may not increase the number of workers by all that much.
So the shale boom is still booming in a very real sense for us and for the rest of the country. Let's talk a bit about ag prices, because this repercussion in the stock market today is the, you know, sort of a volley in what is not necessarily a trade war yet, but is certainly reverberating in that direction. When China imposes 25% tariffs on certain products from this country, including pork, that affects the things that feed pork as well.
Mm-hmm. And look at the soybean market. I mean, China is a huge user of soybeans, and there's no direct tariff on soybeans yet, but there have been some talk in some circles, and I was just talking to people at Soybean Council, that a couple of fairly large orders that were going to go to China have been canceled, you know, and that's $1.5 billion of North Dakota soybeans that are going overseas.
Now, Joe, I know you've been talking about this at KVRR.
Yeah, I know the farmers we've spoken to with the Soybean Council have already made their trips out to the Chinese embassy and talked with some of the officials there and have tried to get a sense of where things go. And they tell us that the Chinese officials say that if they are imposed, the tariffs are imposed, that they will come back and there will be retribution for that.
And today they were talking about actually not staging this retribution that was going to be 15%, then 25%. They're talking about 25% now. And North Dakota and the U.S. aren't the only place that soybeans are grown. Mm-hmm. Once you lose a market, that it can be hard to get it back.
Yeah, there's a real concern on their part. And the Soybean Council here has been very active in getting the word out and trying to rally the soybean industry and the media, for that matter, to get the word out as to what kind of impact it will have, especially here in the state of North Dakota.
And isn't it kind of how things go for farmers, that just in the last 2 years, the state has reversed from being number one, or the number one crop being wheat, to the number one crop being soybeans? And now at that moment when, you know, everybody's really thinking about soybeans, even out here as far west as we are, you know, this could happen where the prices would be hurt by quite a bit.
Another commodity that's on that list for these tariff increases is ethanol, and that could further impact an industry that has been under a bit of strain.
Yeah, and I'm curious as to, and I don't know, does anybody know how much ethanol is shipped to say, a place like China?
I don't know how much North Dakota ethanol is shipped, but apparently they are importing it because they have a mandate there to, I guess, go to a 10% kind of ratio eventually in terms of their petrol use. And, of course, we know they've got an air pollution problem there as well. So this is a brave new world for us.
It is.
I mean, we are in a world economy. North Dakota is very much an exporter of stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And if you think about ethanol, most of it's corn ethanol right now.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a good amount of corn that is planted in North Dakota now.
Well, let's talk about something else that's related to this that the president tweeted about and talked about over the Easter holiday weekend. And he talked about NAFTA again. And that has to make lots of people nervous because, just a reminder, Canada and Mexico are number one and two in terms of the export markets for North Dakota products.
That's very true, too. And I remember talking not too long ago to the Canadian Consul General, who was stationed in Minneapolis. And his message to people in the upper Midwest was, please don't get rid of NAFTA because Canada sees a benefit. And, of course, Canada and North Dakota are huge trading partners, Canada and the northern tier, including Minnesota, Montana, and Washington State, very huge trading partners, and they're worried that some of that might be hurt.
Jim, you hearing anything up where you are, and why not?
Well, not specifically, but I mean, I know there's nervousness about it, and people wonder about, you know, how much of this is bluster from the White House about trying to maybe force some tweaking in the deal that might benefit the United States somehow and not actually scrapping of it. But I think there is a general consensus that it has been a successful endeavor. And didn't it come in during the Clinton administration, to remember right?
I think that's correct, yes.
And, you know, at that point in time, I think there were those who wondered why a Democratic president was doing that, and it was pushed by the Republican legislature or Congress. But, yeah, it's a scary time for folks who, you know, depend on exporting their products out of North
Carolina. Well, whether or not it's a negotiating ploy by the man who, you know, was in the book The Art of the Deal, whether or not it's that, it is this ongoing series of insults against the country south of our border, because that's all tied to this. You know, it's DACA, it's the wall, it's NAFTA. It's kind of hard to untangle all this stuff. I'm hearing a dead silence there, so we're trying to untangle it. I can tell that.
Well, what can you add to that?
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, you've said it all.
Well, that is important, though, and it's an ongoing discussion that we're going to have with probably future editors' roundtables, and we'll be reading it in the newspaper because these trade issues are fundamentally important to the economy of the state where we live and the region we're in, for that matter.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, if you're talking about a commodity-based economy, which North Dakota continues to be, we need the export markets.
Well, more to come on this. Let's move on to another topic here, and that is an interesting Supreme Court debate between Governor Doug Burgum and elements of the North Dakota legislature, specifically the leadership. What did you make of this, Dave? This is still in process. They're still thinking about what the opinion will be from the
Correct.
Supreme Court. But it struck me as a very interesting moment in North Dakota politics, since it was Republican versus Republican.
It is, and the whole issue goes a lot deeper than that, because there were five particular line item vetoes that the governor did. The attorney general ruled that three of them were improper because he vetoed part of a sentence or left some appropriations somewhere, that the other vetoes were okay, and yet he argued the case before the Supreme Court on behalf of the governor.
Yeah.
And he comes up with the other thing, and this has been something that the attorney general has argued for a while, is that the legislature as a whole, the leadership, has put too much power in the budget section, which consists of leadership and the appropriations committees in the House and Senate. And it's a mini legislature because they have power to make some decisions when the legislature is not in session. And Stengem argues, Attorney General Wayne Stengem is arguing, that is an improper delegation of authority to a subset of the legislature. So there are a lot of wheels at play or cogs at play in this whole thing. And for a political junkie, it's a lot of fun to watch.
Well, the governor's statement here was, we stand behind the original intent of these vetoes, and he talks about them being initiated by a small group of legislators at significant cost to taxpayers. The sides seem to be a little bit dug in here, despite the fact that they smile at each other.
That's a good point. But when it comes to the legislature jealously guarding its role as it sees itself as the one with the purse strings, there you can understand why they're really concerned about how these line item vetoes are going to pan out.
No, they're looking at the governor legislating by pinning something out of a sentence and changing literally the meaning of the sentence.
Changing the meaning, that was the comment. And that's why the attorney general, in his opinion, found that some of those vetoes were improper because you had to veto the entire line.
Hasn't it been interesting that it pits kind of a couple of very strong individuals against each other?
Yes.
That being the governor and somebody like Al Carlson, you know what I mean? That those two gentlemen, you know, they know how to get their way a lot of times, I think.
That's right. And let's say they're both from the same town as well as the same party, which has been – I think this is absolutely fascinating, and it's going to be a real nice historical note as the history of North Dakota continues to be written, because this is one of those arguments that is very nuanced in some respects, but is truly the case of one branch of government versus another branch of government.
Well, that's Dave Thompson, our Prairie Public News Director, the voice on the phone, Jim Olson, KXMC-TV News Director, with me in studio here, Joe Radsky. He is the KVRR News Director, and we'll be back with more of our Editor's Roundtable in a moment.
Alexa, play Prairie Public.
Welcome to Prairie Public. Would you like to listen to a radio stream or listen to a podcast?
Radio stream.
If you've got a smart speaker, you can listen to Prairie Public.
Which of the two streams would you like to listen to? Roots, rock, and jazz, or classical and news?
You can also ask Alexa to play Prairie Public Podcasts.
Would you like to listen to Main Street, Natural North Dakota, Chef Rosie, Dakota Datebook, Plains Folk, or Why?
All you have to do is ask.
Alexa, play Prairie Public.
I am on a curiosity voyage, and I need my paddles to travel.
Prairie Public has entered the brave new world
of podcasts.
Catch full episodes of Main Street Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life, and cool Prairie Public features like Tom Ezern's Plains Folk Essay, Matt Olien's Always Timely and Lively Movie Reviews, the flora and fauna infused Natural North Dakota, and if you love food, there's Chef Rosie. And, of course, the Prairie Public favorite that gets passed around on social media a lot.
Dakota Datebook.
Just search for Prairie Public on Apple, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe today.
Then put your earbuds in and boldly listen to Prairie Public podcasts whenever you want.
I want my
podcasts.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and you just heard a reminder that we don't just broadcast, we podcast, we stream live online, so there are lots of ways you can hear Main Street and everything else on Prairie Public. This is our Editor's Roundtable. We have our news directors, Dave Thompson, Jim Olson, and Joe Radsky on, right here, talking to us right today about issues that are important, and we're in the political environment. 2018 is going to be a barn buster of a political year with national repercussions and, of course, very important statewide races as well. Dave, you covered the Democrat NPL convention
yes.
Earlier in March. Give us a kind of a perspective. Give us that event in a nutshell.
The event in a nutshell, what an improvement over 2016. If you remember back to the 2016 Democratic Convention, Democrats left the convention with a few races left unfilled. Now they have all the races filled. And, you know, it was about 625 to 650 delegates there. And they seem to be pretty fired up about the top of the ticket, which would be Senator Heitkamp. And everybody realizes in both parties this is going to be a very tough fought race. There's going to be a lot of money being poured into it, and they're ready. Both parties are going to be ready for that.
Joe, I imagine KVRR, and for that matter, Jim, KXMC, are already running a few ads.
Yeah, we're seeing a good number of national ads coming our way, and I can tell I agree with Dave. It was just seemed like a very enthusiastic group up there. And the Democrats seem to come out with a lot of smiles. But we're expecting you've had Joe Biden in town. You've had Vice President Pence in
yes.
town. I would not put it past President Trump to be here at some point, too. It's going to be
a
big race.
Right.
Yeah, and that's coming up, Dave. You're going to be at the O'Leary Center again later this week, right?
Right, and we're going to be up for the Republican convention this weekend. I think there are some interesting things that are subtext there. The House race. Because Representative Kevin Cramer is going to run for the U.S. Senate. The House race is between two state senators, Kelly Armstrong of Dickinson, Tom Campbell of Grafton. And from what we hear, that if Tom Campbell does not get the nomination, he probably will challenge in the primary, which another interesting dimension to that. And it'll be interesting to hear what kind of arguments and messages are going to come out of that convention as well, contrast them with what the Democrats are saying.
Well, on the Democrat side, you've got Max Schneider is in the race now,
mm-hmm.
and Ben Hansen.
Has he
dropped out now?
He has dropped out now
okay.
since Max Schneider got the nomination. Ben Hansen is not going to run in the primary, and we understand John Grabinger is not going to run in the primary either.
So that puts Max Schneider, who's a pretty potent legislator in his own right. He was the Senate Minority Leader, wasn't
mm-hmm.
he?
He is. That's why I think it's going to be interesting, because the House seat becomes an open House seat if Representative Cramer is going to take the Senate race. And I think, you know, that's going to be one to watch. I really am thinking about that. Both top of the ticket races this time are going to be very interesting to watch.
Well, I think nationally the pundits are saying this one's too close to call. That is the Senate race between Heidi Heitkamp and Kevin Cramer. That in itself is interesting because, you know, this is a staunchly Republican state in many ways. Jim, what's the chat about where you are?
I think it's interesting that we, you know, we're, as these two gentlemen have mentioned, that we're seeing already kind of an inflow of outside money, you know, running advertisements. And, you know, we have somebody portraying Heidi Heitkamp on a Republican ad and some interesting things like that that are going on. It's a long way to go, and that's going to be a knockdown, drag-out fight between, I think, a couple of, you know, pretty pretty solid politicians, I think, who probably each one feels like he or she should be a good choice. Obviously, Senator Heitkamp has been there now for 6 years. Now, in that GOP race, I'm interested, you know, Tom Campbell has invested a lot in getting his name known across the state over the past several months when he first thought he was going to be running for Senate and then moved back to the House race after Cramer made his decision. I think he's in an interesting spot where, you know, if somebody like Kelly Armstrong gets the nod this coming weekend, he probably almost has to mount a challenge just to make it worth his time that he's invested already so far.
Mm-hmm. Well, putting his name out there too, Kelly Armstrong is advertising in the tens of thousands of dollars on all three stations here in Fargo, so he is making a big, big push, and it's only April 2nd.
How about Tom Campbell, though, funding people to become delegates or to be delegates at the state convention, Dave? Are you hearing anything about that?
I'm hearing a lot of back-channel talk about that, saying there are people within the Republican Party power structure who are wondering, you know, how proper is that, and will there be a challenge to seat some delegates who were paid for by the Campbell campaign? It's just back channel talk right now. I have not heard anything in terms of specific proposals, but there's some back channel talk about what might happen.
Well, just one more question about this big Senate race, though. Has anybody heard a bottom line about how much each one of these candidates, that is Heidi Heitkamp and Kevin Cramer, are going to spend during this election cycle to win?
What I'm hearing, well, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I haven't heard a number. I'd be interested to see what you say. But, I mean, you have to add to that what they're going to spend, plus what their parties will spend and what the special interest groups will spend.
Actually,
you know,
exactly.
It's going to add up to a lot.
Exactly. Now, I'm hearing in the $30 to $40 million range.
Well, consider a state of 750,000 people, and not all of them, of course, are going to be voting. That comes to a pretty significant number per person. That's quite an investment.
It is. For a
Senate seat. Let's briefly talk about some of these other races. The Attorney General, we've got incumbent Wayne Stengem versus Dave Thompson.
Not me.
No, David Thompson from Grand Forks. Although you went to UND, aren't there anymore.
No. But I will tell you that when the name was called, I really thought, and I should have done this, I should have run up to the podium and said, I appreciate the nomination, but I have to decline because I don't have a law degree.
Okay.
If elected, I will not serve.
Exactly.
Well, Wayne Stengem's been the incumbent for a very long time. I assume the money's on him?
Well, the money's on him. What was funny is when we were talking about the argument, after the argument at the Supreme Court, the legislature versus Burgum, Governor Burgum and Attorney General were outside the courtroom, and he shouts, Wayne Stengem shouts out so everybody can hear, "Hey, there's my opponent!" And points at me.
Okay. Well, how about that Secretary of State race? Incumbent Al Jager, been there for a long time, facing a primary challenge from another Republican, isn't he?
Well, it's going to be a challenge of the convention. A former Republican district chair from Mandan, and I know that there's been opinions in the forum and some other things saying that that shouldn't happen, but it does happen, and that's going to be the last race they will endorse on Sunday afternoon.
Okay.
And wasn't he challenged also last time around, Dave? Do I remember that right? By his own party?
I think that might be right.
The person's name, but...
Yeah. But, he's facing an inter-party challenge. And, of course, the Democrats have nominated Josh Boucher from Fargo.
Okay. And Agriculture Commissioner, we've got incumbent Doug Goring versus Jim Dotsenrod of Winemere. Tax Commissioner, incumbent Ryan Rauschenberger versus the Democrat Kylie Overson of Grand Forks. And Public Service Commissioner, incumbents Randy Christman versus Gene Brandt of Cramer and Brian Crocius versus Casey Buckman of Washburn. Awesome. So lots of stuff going on. We've got our editor's roundtable. It's convened, and we'll be back with them right after the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Minnesota health officials are stepping up their efforts to reduce teen suicide. The Minnesota Health Department's Melissa Heinen says because of a federal grant, the department is launching an initiative in areas with scarce resources.
We're working with 16 health and behavioral health care liaisons to implement a program called Zero Suicide Model. And this is where they change the way that they are addressing individuals that are increased risk for suicide. They make suicide prevention a core component of how they deliver health care.
Minnesota's suicide rate for people between the ages of 10 and 24 is higher than the national average. In 2016, 111 people in that age group committed suicide. China's additional tariffs on U.S. goods that took effect today include pork imports. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer says that American pork farmers rely on overseas sales, so this could be a big problem.
China's upping its taxes on a long list of products, including wine, nuts, and fruit, to as much as 25%. But pork is a big one. National Pork Producers Council spokesman Jim Monroe says last year, China imported more than $1 billion of U.S. pork.
China is a very important market for us. It's the number one pork-consuming nation in the world, and our industry's growth is coming from exports.
China's tariffs are in response to the Trump administration imposing higher taxes on steel and aluminum. Iowa State University economist Wendong Zhang says China is sending a clear message. It's willing to fight a trade war. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
And North Dakota's insurance department will be undertaking a market conduct examination of Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Dakota.
I use the term loosely, kind of look under the hood a little bit.
Insurance Commissioner John Gottfried.
If you look across the country, just about every insurance company, major insurance company, they're examined every 3 to 5 years. So this isn't anything outside of the norm, and it's really one of my duties as insurance commissioner to ensure that our consumers are getting the services that they're being promised.
Gottfried says he's been assured by Blue Cross of its full cooperation in this.
I hope it doesn't turn adversarial. It has in the past. I think there's some history there of push and pull. I'm hoping it doesn't go that way, but again, it is also my duty to again ensure that they're following the laws and regulations and that our consumers are getting what they're entitled to.
Gottfried says this exam will likely take 6 to 8 months to complete. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. We're holding our Editor's Roundtable. We do this every month, and Dave Thompson, our Prairie Public News Director, is a regular. He's by our microphone in Bismarck. Jim Olson joins us by phone from Minot, where he is the News Director for KXMC-TV. And Joe Ransky is with me here in studio. Joe is the News Director at KVRR in Fargo. Let's talk about flood control projects. Jim, I know that some movement has happened with your particular project up in Minot with the Souris River.
Right. The groundbreaking was held last week, and for the first portions of the project actually in the city of Minot, which, of course, is where the vast majority of people live along the river, but there's still a commitment to provide flood protection from border to border, from where the river enters the U.S. near Sherwood to where it leaves the U.S. near West Hope. But nevertheless, this is the vast majority of the expense, the portion that would protect Minot. So the first three phases of this multi-phase project are now officially underway. They total about $100 million in construction costs, and it will take about 3 years to complete. And then the big question mark comes after that, and that's how do they continue to get funding for this? The state has really soaked a lot of money into this. I can't remember the exact number. I don't have it in front of me, but I think it was $160 million so far, and $190 million, expecting another $160 over the next several years. And the local people have put money in through a sales tax, but the federal government has not really put anything in yet to the flood protection part of this. And the Corps of Engineers is within about a year or so of making a decision as to whether it will get involved in the next phase, which would be called Phase 4, which will tie together Phases 1, 2, and 3 and provide protection for everyone on the north side of the river. So it would be about 60 to 65% of the city's population would be protected if Phases 1 through 4 are all in place. And so that's a big push for the local organizers, is to get the Corps of Engineers and for the federal legislators to get the Corps to commit to doing this and then find the funding within the process in Congress to get that fourth phase built immediately after 1-3, so that maybe 5 or 6 years from now we can say, well, more than half of the city is protected. Now they have to start working on the other half.
Wow. Well, that's a long time. I mean, the flood event was in June of 2011, so it just reminds us of how long it can take for this kind of significant infrastructure to be put in place.
Yeah, very difficult. And at the same time, they are, again, 7 years into it, the International Joint Commission is moving forward with an effort to come up with a new management plan to better manage the dams that already exist on the river and perhaps make some changes to how they, you know, regulate the water that runs out of those dams. Changes, you know, the last time around could have made a difference in how bad the flooding was, but nevertheless, it's 7 years later and they still haven't made any of the changes yet, but they're moving forward with a study of that.
I went up on the website about the project in Minot, and I noticed that there are some significant flood walls that are planned. There are also some diversion channels, Minot having a little bit of relief, that is, valleys and hills and things like that to store water. That probably helps a bit.
Yeah, that phase four, by the way, is the diversion. It's called the Maple Diversion, so it would be where water would flow when it was over a certain rate, and it would divert into that channel to keep flooding to a minimum.
And you reminded us that because it's the Souris River, that's an IJC issue. That's between the U.S. and Canada, so that complicates things a little bit. Our complication here in Fargo-Moorhead is the state border. And as Dave Thompson knows, and of course Joe Radsky knows, the issue between North Dakota and Minnesota and Fargo, and frankly Minnesota, has been where the people will be most affected. And there has been a plan B proposed, Joe.
There certainly has been. And it seems like once the governors of both states got involved, it seemed to bring some clarity to it. It seemed to be everybody kind of began to think on the same page. And it seems like – it seems to feel positive. It feels like things are moving in the right direction and that there's a – that this will be approved.
Well, as we say, it ain't over till it's over.
Right.
But it is great to have where the buck stops, where those people are, you know, talking to each other and smiling, you know.
Yeah.
But it's up to Tom Leindecker, the DNR commissioner now, at least for his vote of approval, if you will. And that's sort of where things stand now.
And I guess there's some sense of urgency to try to get some resolution because as time goes on, the cost goes up.
And, of course, the potential, the odds go up, too, because these flood events do happen, not necessarily with, you know, a forecast regularity, but where we are is pan flat. If we get lots of snow, lots of moisture at the wrong time, it's not just the river, it's overland flooding. So this is everybody's focused here who's mm-hmm. been through a flood event in Fargo-Moorhead, I can tell you that. Let's move on to another issue that the president dropped over the weekend as he was talking about NAFTA and other things. He says DACA is dead. That's the sort of the rule that was protecting a certain select group of Mexican Americans who were actually born in Mexico and brought to this country as kids and have grown up knowing only this country. And the president is now suggesting that maybe 800,000 of these people are in peril of being, you know, deported.
And it's interesting because if the polls are to be believed, most people in the U.S. think that the DACA kids should not be deported. And there might be some, as you said earlier, there might be some negotiation kind of tactic that's involved in this. He really wanted to have a kind of a swap, the DACA program for the border wall. That did not happen, and he's trying to blame the Democrats for that.
Well,
and, you know, the Democrats did stop the wall in some respects.
Yes, but the president is the one who lifted the DACA protection.
That's
and that
right.
was last year, and this has been a come up political football since then. For those listeners who are wondering what the effect is for where we live, North Dakota has about 100 young people that would be affected by this, South Dakota about 300, and the state of Minnesota 6,300. So mm-hmm. it's not insignificant, certainly to those people and their families and all their friends and the folks who support them and don't want them, you know, going away. So it's an issue that's out there that it plays with other issues. It's political. And it makes people a little uneasy, I think.
Yeah, it certainly plays down in downtown Fargo with some of the questions by the commission, by Dave Pipcorn, about refugees and the money being spent to comfort them and to bring them into town. But we haven't seen a whole lot of the faces. You know, we haven't seen the DACA faces yet. And I think once people start seeing those, I think, as Dave said, that they're going to start hearing more and more about that.
Mm-hmm. Another big national issue that should be affecting people by now, I've looked into it myself, I'll be honest about that, is the federal income tax cuts that were announced last year and now are in play. Mm-hmm. Anybody checked their pay stub lately?
I have been wanting to do that, but I keep forgetting. I apologize, but I keep forgetting to do that.
I did it. I netted $15.08 more per pay period. But when I put it up against my increase in my Medicare, because I am of a certain age, I actually come out $8 ahead every month.
Yeah, I didn't see a number, but yeah, I did the same thing. I looked and saw that there was a little more in the check.
Yeah. Hmm.
Yeah.
So I've got my two lattes now, and I'm happy about that. But obviously, this is going to be a big issue. It's going to be talked about in front of these elections coming up, particularly those with national importance. And it's an important victory, I think, that the Republicans were touting. We'll see mm-hmm. how well it plays.
Well, especially just recently, that didn't it say that North Dakota's taxpayers will benefit more than any other states because of those tax cuts?
Yeah, I saw something on there was some kind of study from a couple of different foundations that said North Dakota and South Dakota were the big winners.
Well, we'll see, because people do notice what they take home.
Or should notice what they take home,
yes,
in my
okay.
case.
let's move on to a very explosive issue that just happened, actually, and it's been simmering out there. People have been talking about it. There have been some commentators on it, but over the weekend, an online media organization called Deadspin dropped a video of lots of anchors at Sinclair Broadcasting stations reading the same message from HQ, and I've got some TV background. I know that Jim certainly is currently involved in it, as is Joe. I would be interested in getting your impressions about what you've seen and what's happening.
Right. That was from the Sinclair Broadcast Group, and that's the largest ownership group of television stations in the country. And as you mentioned, there was apparently a corporate mandate that said, this story should be done or this script should be done. I guess I'm not exactly sure what the format of it was.
I think it was a promo.
It was a promo.
Everybody read the same thing.
And but it was the anchors who did it, I believe.
Right. That's correct.
Right.
So, I mean, it gives it the weight of the news department then. And this related to, you know, the fake news issue. And, to their credit, they said, you know, if you feel like we're not being fair, you know, here's our website. Go and complain and we'll, you know, whatever. But it was kind of the same message going out everywhere. I can tell you that I work for Nexstar, which is the second largest television ownership group in the country, and I've never seen anything like that from Nexstar. Nexstar does kind of pride itself on being smaller to medium-sized markets. Sinclair is more of a larger market group. But nevertheless, I haven't seen that. We will send reporters to certain events, like I think we have a reporting group at the Masters, for instance, and they'll send out stories that all of the stations can use, kind of like a network, and but have never seen in the 2 years we've been associated with them anything that said, here's a story everybody's got to do, get on it.
Well, Sinclair ownership, as I worked for Sinclair when I was in Milwaukee, and they have always had the ownership, has always been a conservative side. They were behind the Swift Boat stories back early on, and the ownership has always tried to been a little bit of a challenge to Fox. And at that time, we had commentaries that were must run, and all took a conservative side. And they currently have a commentary that must run on every station, and has a conservative side also. So, and they're also the station group that reached out to Donald Trump when he was running for president, and offered him time on air whenever he was available. They claim they did for everyone else, but they were one of the first to, you know, put their hand out and say, Donald Trump, we want to hear what you have to say.
I think the most unsettling thing about this is that who has to read the script, and that is the anchors, the people who represent the newsrooms, the ones that are supposed to be objective and fair in a very real sense. Why wasn't this vice president for Sinclair Broadcasting just taping this thing and having it run on all those stations? Why not put his face out there instead of imposing this, literally, this journalistic burden on people who are representing a newsroom?
Well, Jim, you have to wonder, too, that what was the dialogue, what was the discussion in these newsrooms? Because these newsrooms were not Sinclair a year ago or maybe 5 years ago. And these journalists, I would assume, had some real hard, tough questions.
Journalists typically do.
Which, before they would go do it, yeah.
And so, I bet there was plenty of spirited discussion in newsrooms with their corporate news directors and that sort of thing. Of talking about this, especially now, it's the old, they're sorry that they were discovered. They weren't sorry they did it, but you know what I mean? Especially now with it in the news, everybody's going to be talking about it in those newsrooms, I'm sure.
Yes, and it might be something that actually blows back on the parent company. We'll have to wait and see whether that happens. But in the meantime, there are a lot of anchors with egg on their face, literally. Because
I have familiarity with that.
Yeah, well, I do too. let's talk about something pretty serious here, too, to finish with, and that is the passing of somebody who was very important to the state of North Dakota. And I know it's been some time, some weeks now since this happened, but we haven't had an editor's roundtable since that, and that's the passing of Governor George Sinner.
An amazing person who had an absolutely wicked sense of humor, but somebody who really was described to me by Democrats as saying in any other state he'd be a moderate Republican. He was one of those people you could easily talk to. And just a little anecdote to tell you about Governor Sinner. There'd be a group of four or five reporters sitting in the Capitol. And he'd see us, and he'd come barreling up and tell us the nastiest jokes. But we loved it. And then nobody ever reported about the jokes. He liked that sense. He had a great sense of humor on that. He was probably one of the more accessible governors that I've worked with. He had a fairly open-door policy and would talk to you about the issues. And he held very frequent news conferences to talk to reporters about the issues. And he also liked the sparring.
Yes, and he was whip smart as well.
He was whip smart.
And I know that one of his proudest achievements was the Tri-College University, which was the cooperative arrangement that involved North Dakota State, Minnesota State, Moorhead, and Concordia College to give all of those students better access to, you know, classes at other campuses. That's changed a bit over the years, but he was a champion of higher education and a champion of the state of North Dakota, and he will be missed.
Mm-hmm. We'll just, again, one more quick anecdote, and I apologize for kind of monopolizing some of the conversation, but remember, he actually proposed that North Dakota only have 75 school districts at one point. And that was during a time when he became governor, the state had gone through an oil bust where the price of oil went down to $5 a barrel, if you can see that back in 83, 84, 85. And there was times in 1986 that there were no drilling rigs working in North Dakota. So this was kind of the hand he was dealt. And remember, he came up with something called Growing North Dakota to try to move the economy a little off so much dependence on commodities.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that. Dave Thompson, Jim Olson, Joe Radsky, thanks for being on our Editor's Roundtable today.
Thank you much.
Glad to be here.
Coming up next, Tom Eason.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and a regular on our program is Tom Eason, a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and the man who writes the Plains Folk essays. And today, Tom's essay is titled Gregarious Geese.
In the changing seasons of the prairies,
There are certain developments that capture our attention for their continentality. There are sprawling events that progress up the latitudinal length of the Great Plains. Digital communications make it possible for us to follow the progression of the small grain harvest from Texas to Alberta, beginning in May, when custom harvesters get to work in North Texas. There are the official harvest labor and grain elevator reports, and there are the many bloggers and posters from the ranks of the harvesters themselves. Waterfowl migrations are another north-south link on the Great Plains. Birders eagerly await the massing of elegant sandhill cranes in the Platte River Valley. Those who view waterfowl not only with binoculars but also over a gun barrel attend to the movements of snow geese. Websites and apps keep them current as to goose movements across the prairies. Such attention by hunters to snow geese in spring dates from 1999, when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service issued a conservation order permitting spring hunting. The service at that time estimated the number of snow geese at 15 to 25 million, way up from a little over a million a quarter century earlier. There followed liberalized regulations for shooting snow geese, allowing hunters to do things not permitted in fall hunting seasons, play recorded calls over sound systems, use unplugged magazines, and shoot bodacious numbers of birds. A whole new industry of game guiding arose, following the geese north. This 21st century boom in snow goose hunting leads me to say two things. First, from the point of view of policy and life on the plains, we need to be careful about our habits of thought. Wildlife managers and waterfowl scientists fell into certain habits of thinking about waterfowl on the plains, habits which we might call, from an analytic point of view, declensionist, by which I mean they assumed that human effects necessarily wrought decline and, unless something was done to stop it, destruction of wildlife. The history of waterfowl management, commonly told, is one of struggle, of good guys against bad guys, greedy market hunters first, and after that, profit-maximizing farmers. Plus, there was that Dust Bowl thing and the wetland crisis of the 1930s. So, backed up by federal legislation, waterfowl managers fought heroically to stabilize habitat while regulating harvest. What they didn't reckon on was developments off their screen, how snow geese, adapting nicely to agricultural change on the prairies and benefiting from conservation efforts, would produce a population explosion and eat up their Arctic nesting grounds. The second thing I want to say about these geese is that in the rush to lock and load, we ought not to forget the aesthetic pleasure and the natural fascination manifest in the swirling flocks of snowy birds. The greatest of Great Plains naturalists, Paul A. Johnsgaard, in his 1978 classic, Ducks, Geese, and Swans of the World, writes that of all the waterfowl, snow geese are perhaps the most gregarious of all. Hence the unfathomable flocks of glittering birds milling above our fields and marshes every year. They are the more fascinating when we realize that a massive flock is composed of family groups, each acting as a unit, but together in a wonderfully complex dance composing the flock. Somewhere in the action of that flock, I see a metaphor, but I'm not sure what to do with it.
Parents, students, decision makers, everybody's a stakeholder in the success of education in North Dakota. And that is why Prairie Public Education Services has teamed up with North Dakota United, the North Dakota Department for Public Instruction, and innovation expert Ted Dintersmith for the weekly Cutting Ed podcast. Hosted by Tom Gerhart, The Cutting Ed explores education innovations in our state. You can find The Cutting Ed wherever you get your podcasts or at ndunited.org/thecuttinged.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 2nd. A reference to coal country often evokes images of the hills of West Virginia or Kentucky. Rarely does North Dakota leap to mind.
But the state has the largest single deposit of lignite coal in the world, with an estimated 351 billion tons still in the ground. While lignite never matched agriculture as a North Dakota product, it continues to be a valuable commodity. About 32 million tons are mined annually. North Dakota has a long history of coal production. With a shortage of trees, settlers used coal for cooking and heating. It also powered steamboats. The first North Dakota coal mine was opened in 1873. By the early 1920s, over 250 coal mines in the state produced over 1 million tons of lignite. In 1920, General William Washburn opened North Dakota's largest mine at Wilton. But the needs of the coal industry sometimes clashed with the needs of settlers. On this date in 1909, many settlers in McLean County were in a state of confusion regarding their claims. Entire townships in the county had been withdrawn as potential sites for settlement while they were inspected for signs of coal. This included land that had already been claimed. Some of the land had already been surveyed. In March of 1909, Representative A.J. Grana of McLean County contacted the Department of the Interior and asked for a quick resolution. He pointed out that settlers could not finalize their claims until the matter was settled and they were issued the required patent for the land. Grana received a reply 2 days later. Acting Commissioner S.V. Proudfit explained that the McLean County land was involved in the coal question. But in the waning days of the previous legislative session, Congress passed a law returning the land to public entry. Proudfit said that McLean County would be affected by the recent legislation and added that action was only waiting on the final report. The Washburn leader reported that the unsettled state of affairs had been resolved. The newspaper expected that all suspended and unsettled proofs would be quickly decided and the patents assured. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
In Memphis, Tennessee, Martin Luther King gave a speech. It was April 3rd, 1968.
We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop.
50 years later, we look back at the work King was doing in Memphis before his assassination on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, Bill Thomas will join us with a conversation about art that provokes discomfort. And this comes from a panel discussion with writers Nicholas Gallinan, Marlon James, and Lauren Markham. It took place at the UND Writers Conference a couple of weeks ago. A grand opening is coming up for the Northwest Arts Center and its new Walter Peel Gallery at Minot State University. Arts Center Director Avis Veikley will tell us what to expect. So we hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.